planning boards that are more and more regulating hospitals these days came and said to Lutheran Deaconess and then to St. Mary of Nazareth Hospital, which is located across the street from it, that one or the other ought to go out of business, because the day had come when it was impossible to run a hospital at the 200 or 250 bed level, and it had become necessary to move to at least 400 beds in order to spread the overhead over enough patients to make a hospital financially feasible. Well, there was a long hassle over the thing about who should go out of business, and St. Mary of Nazareth won the argument because the area had become almost exclusively Puerto Rican, or very largely Puerto Rican, and therefore Catholic, and they didn't want to leave a Catholic constituency in the area. So Lutheran General then moved to a new location, and it moved out where the demographers had suggested the center of population for that area would be in the year 2000, and that was to be the center of a new megapolis that would go from up around Green Bay, Wisconsin, down way down into Indiana, and then from over towards Omaha all the way across to Detroit and join the big Pittsburgh Toledo one. They expect, you know, just one mass of humanity going from north of Boston and sweeping down to Washington area and then coming across the country below the lakes. And so, at any rate, they put a pin on the map at a certain spot, and so this is a good in-between point, and that's where the hospital was built. Hospital is somewhat unique. It's, by the way, owned by the American Lutheran Church, sponsored by them. And it's a situation in which a church was willing to put itself on the line in the healthcare area in ways that went beyond just ownership of property. Most hospitals, if they have a tie to the church, find that the best definition of the relationship is financial and has very little to do with the church's operation in what goes on in the hospital. But they were willing to put their necks out a little bit. They did even financially. They went on the interim paper for about $3.5 million, and if the hospital hadn't made it in the first couple of years, the American Lutheran Church would have been bankrupt and out of existence long ago. They don't have that much money. But it worked. It has grown in 17 years or so to an 850-bed hospital, which makes it one of the very largest private hospitals in the country. But Lutheran General Hospital in Cartridge. There are less than 0.5% of the hospitals in the country that are that size, which is a little surprising. The hospital has done fairly well financially, as it's always kept its head above water and has been able to do something that perhaps some hospitals haven't been able to do, and that is to do a lot of its own financing out of its reserve funds, which then cuts down patient cost. So that, for instance, reflected by the fact that being a teaching hospital, if you compare it with the other teaching hospitals in the Chicago area, the rates there are the lowest of any hospital in the area. If you compare their rates with simply community hospitals, then they're at the midpoint of community hospitals. So that the rate structure is something like a miracle in itself, but mostly, and I think probably out of some pretty good management, that is, and the size, which has made it possible for them to spread their overhead. Four other hospitals in the area built at the same time, within the same opening within a year, have not gone beyond the 250-bed place, which says something about public acceptance of the hospital. And when we ask about public acceptance and the reasons for it of our patients, the answer was always that here there was something personal about the care, as over against the simply technological. And that has been a theme throughout the hospital, and I think it's one of the evidences of the church. When we talk about the nature of man and the necessity and essential nature of the realization of personhood and personal relationships, then that ought to carry out into everything. It ought to be in schools, it ought to be in churches, it ought to be in hospitals, it ought to be in neighborhoods, it ought to be in everything that's done. This ought to be very clear, that depersonalization is an evil and personalization becomes a good and a health-restoring factor. There are some other differences in that hospital, just to wind things up a little bit. Like, for instance, most hospitals of that size might have two or even three chaplains. Sometimes a training program that has a few more students around. The Lutheran General has 30 full-time, specially trained chaplains, plus about 15 students, so that the number of clergymen in the building on any one day is about 45, which makes it an unusual situation. But those pastors that are working have an average of 3 years training beyond theological seminary, specifically in their fields, and they kind of subspecialize in that. Some are, two of them, for instance, are working only with terminal illness and with the victims of terminal illness. Four of them are working entirely with psychiatric patients. Two of them are working exclusively with coronary patients. And so on throughout the institution. There are about the same number of social workers, and about the same number of psychiatrists. There's psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, a number of about 38. So that the people are there, at least, and the disciplines are there to start treating whole persons. The way in which it works, let me just take one failure and give you an idea of how it doesn't work. A woman came into the hospital some time ago with a rather severe coronary. She would not have arrived alive if it hadn't been for modern technology that could dispatch a very sophisticated vehicle, or a vehicle with very sophisticated equipment, you've all seen these on TV at least, to the scene with well-trained medics aboard who could evaluate, or at least wire the person up for evaluation. And then, by the use of sophisticated telemetry, the cardiologist could, back at the hospital, see what was going on in that heart and suggest what ought to be done. And she was on the floor in her home for about 45 minutes after the medics arrived, before the cardiologist said, okay, she seems to be stabilized, let's take her in. And then they continued stabilizing treatment methods until she came into the hospital alive. Now, this woman would not have, in all probability, been alive if it had been 5 years before, or 3 or 4 years before, even, because the situation was so bad that when they found her, they got there within 6 or 7 minutes of the time that she fell down with this very severe coronary. Then she went into a very sophisticated kind of treatment program, and that all the stops that modern technology has made available. But somehow or another, we goofed on this one. Looking back later, nurses and others said that they could remember now that she seemed to be increasingly agitated in the last 3 or 4 days before she was to go home from the hospital. But somebody had just failed to hear what she was saying by her agitation and her restlessness. And what she was saying probably was that she was afraid to go home and get into the mess again. Now, later, she came back to the hospital about 2-3 days later, but She came back dead. She was dead on arrival. Then it's a tragic thing, and could conceivably have been prevented. But somehow or another, we missed salient facts in this total person illness, which is a coronary or myocardial infarction. Now, what had happened was that the night before she had her first coronary, the police came to the door and pounded loudly on the door at about 1:30 in the morning, woke the family up, and had a search warrant for her daughter's room, or for the house. The daughter was just under 16 years old at the time, and it was estimated that she had made $12,000 selling drugs, selling cocaine at the high school parking lot during the 12 months before. Pretty good income for a kid that age. She herself, the girl herself, was not on drugs. Well, she had experimented a little bit earlier, but in no way was she hung up on drugs. She was just a businesswoman. Now, the father was a rather influential man and had kept this out of the papers, it kept it out of the public knowledge, and it kept it away from his wife. So it was only the daughter and the husband who knew about this and knew that she'd been arrested about four times, but each time the father had managed to get her out without going to jail. The mother found out about it when the police did come, banging on the door at that time of the night. There was no way that the mother couldn't find out. And all of a sudden, she was bombed with this whole news all at once, in a vacuum of communication, because nobody had told her anything about this, which is a dreadful thing for anybody to go through. About 4 or 5 hours after that was when she had her coronary. Then, when she was ready to go home, of course, she was going to go back to that same situation, and nobody had dealt with that one. We had dealt with some other things with her. But she had not wanted to get into much of the broader therapy, had been resistant to the chaplain's offer for help, and to the nurse's encouragement. The social workers were never given a try, even at it. She just shied away entirely from that one. But where our failure was, not in offering resources that could conceivably have helped, but where our failure was in not finding a way to make it possible for her to accept it. So then she walks back in and finds that the same situation is all there. The first thing that happened was a big hassle when she found out that her daughter was now in jail and she hadn't been informed while she was at home or while she was at the hospital. And then a big fight between the husband and the woman over the matter of, why wasn't I told? How come we never communicate? And the pain and agony of this family, which had gone untreated, killed the woman. And she was couldn't survive that second accident. Now, in other situations, and you can't, it's easier to sometimes to prove something from failure than it is from successes. The successes are a little hard to measure. How many people are alive because they came into groups, like a group like this, all of you having had a heart problem that has brought you into the hospital, and you sit in groups like this and start talking under the leadership of chaplain or social worker or psychiatrist or all three, and nurses present, and family very often present. So that there's a group therapy often extending out from the patient to his family in dealing with the problems of stress and of future care and all the aspects of the disease. It's amazing how important the fellow patients are in the process, because the fellow patients do exactly like they do in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. they call the bluff. The businessman said, well, I just got a little too busy. I really don't have any serious problem with my heart. My heart's all right, except that our company was going through a tough thing, and my heart's in good condition. And he keeps telling you how, you know, overstating, you know, he's scared stiff and lying to himself, and he's denying. And if you want to see real denial, then take a doctor who's at a coronary. A study was made a few years ago, and doctors are about 25% higher on some kind of a measuring scale on the number of the percentage of denials on coronary heart disease and coronary artery disease and on other forms of heart problem. But when that happens in the group, somebody says, oh, I know. We've heard this before. It was just because a temporary little stress that'll never happen again was thrown at you. But it is the kind of a guy you are. You're the kind that's going to bring that briefcase home every weekend. I'll bet you a dollar, says some guy sitting alongside. I was just like you. You're the kind that always got to bring your work home for your office. You've never got time to sit down with your family. You never relax. You're always buzzing all the time. And how is success. You got to get there. You got to get that next promotion. You got to keep going up. And finally, the patients start by calling the bluff. Now, not that the patient is patient number one now, the guy who's on the spot is trying to deceive somebody, but he's kind of deceiving himself into thinking there's nothing really wrong and lifestyle, life pattern has nothing to do with it. Well, accidents are another of these places where we like to get deeply into the relational factors and the religious factors, the spiritual religious. Because people with legalistic religious background break more bones than do people who don't have the legalistic religious background. The more rigid the religious expression, the more bones you break. That's been well established. Now, so it's a little dangerous to be under the law. Now, the reason is, I think any high school kid could figure it out. The reason is that if you're always wondering what's the will of God, always wondering if you're doing the right thing, your muscles tone up in a different way. They overtone because you symbolize it with the muscles of your body. Again, you're a whole person. You're not, you know, split off so that you can have a relationship to God that has nothing to do with your tissues, you know, and your muscles. It can't be done. Your relationship to God is reflected in the muscle tone. The peace of God, which passeth all understanding, gets into cells and into chemistry of your body. And if you ain't got that peace, then your muscles are going to be tense. And the guy who trips on the top step and misses all subsequent steps and ends up with some broken bones is the guy who's walking kind of stiff-legged and tense. Or the person who starts to cross the street and said, maybe I should have done that, and turns around. See, it gets to be a pattern of life. Relaxation gets to be a pattern, or oughtness gets to be a pattern. I ought to have done this, or I should do this, or, you know, I must do this. Growing out of that inner core of the person that has or has not peace. The driven person, always wondering, have I done right? Is this the right thing to do? Living under that, there's more tendency towards erratic physical behavior. Turning around all of a sudden to go back and do something else. Driving a car, they're a menace. Alcohol is bad news on the highway or in the streets, but the legalistic religious person is just as much of a menace. They're not so identifiable. Well,
I've got the right of way.
Yes, or I don't have the right of way. I've got to get back here some way and swing the car right into the guy on the other side of you. to get back where you think you ought to be. It's kind of a jitteriness that comes from a lack of peace. Now, an enormous number of automobile accidents are also caused by people who just fought with their wives. That's another, you know, but you can't identify that so easily either. You can usually tell a drunk driver going down the street, or it's a little easier. But how do you tell the guy who can't even see the street because he's still fighting with his wife and drives preoccupied or worried because his kids are on drugs? Goodness, if you have any problems like that, you know, stay away from a car, get somebody else to drive, because it's dangerous business. There aren't many accidents, is all I'm saying. Accidents are among the least accidental things, the most predictable things imaginable. A bunch of people came into the hospital one night. It was very early in the game, and it was the time I was still functioning as a chaplain, or at least the supervisor chaplain. And one of the fellows got sick one night, so I took his duty. And it was a night stint, and the hospital had just been open a few weeks. And I was awakened by a telephone call in my room and saying, you better get down here, chaplain, because there's an ambulance coming in with a bad one. Well, it turned out to be four bad ones, four kids. A 17-year-old boy, a 16-year-old boy, and two 15-year-old girls. And they'd all been drinking, and they were mashed up. Oh, it was ugly, ugly, ugly sight. These beautiful little kids that had just been smashed in over a 90 mile an hour automobile accident. They'd gone off the freeway. All of them had been drinking. And it was 2:00 on a Sunday morning. Well, I don't know anything about how to fix up bones that are sticking into lungs or to put fluid back in to keep pressure up when they've leaked too much blood out through 100 holes, or how to repair a spleen that's been mashed. But the hospital's a wonderful place at moments like that. Things come alive all of a sudden. It can be sleepy as can be at 2:00 in the morning, and all of a sudden it's very much alive. And people came from outside of the hospital to help with this thing right away, doctors and nurses and others. They worked all night long, nobody having much hope that any of them would be alive by morning, but they all were. And the only thing I could do was start thinking about families, because there was nothing I could do with those kids at all. I couldn't even go near them, they were all unconscious. And it would have been an intrusion, a dangerous intrusion, if I had tried to get near them. And they were working desperately to save their lives. So I started to call the family of each one. Going through all these bloody purses and wallets and things to try to find some identification, and we found identification on all of them. One of them I called the grumpy father, and I think I would probably be somewhat the same way when the phone rang. It's about between 2 and 3 in the morning. And he just said, wrong number, and hung up. And 3 times before I shouted at him, before he got a chance to tell me it was wrong number, and get him to pause long enough. And then I said, this is Lutheran General Hospital calling. I may have some bad news for you, but I must find out first. Are you the father of, so-and-so? Yes. Well, we found some identification. The girl has just been brought into the hospital, rather seriously hurt. And we'd like to have you come over. And he said, my daughter's in bed. Can't be her. And I said, well, your name is such and such. Yes, she's such and such age. You live at such and such an address. Yes. Well, her ID card gives that. And he said, no, she went to bed early tonight. She went to bed at 10:00. I said, would you go up and ask her who might have her ID card? And already I was suspecting what had happened. He comes back and he says, my God, she isn't there. Well, she'd gone up early to fool the family. And the necessity to do this or the desire to do it and the rebellion that's involved, again, is part of the whole situation. Well, they came over to the hospital, the father and the mother. Another one, we didn't get a hold of until the next, another set of parents, we didn't get a hold of them until late the next day because they were out on a party that was a party to end all parties. And when we finally located them about noon the next day, they were still so drunk that they couldn't possibly come into the hospital. They didn't sober up until about 8 or 9 o'clock the next night, almost 24 hours later. One father said, again, huh? And just said, hell with him. That kid has been nothing but trouble. That was the driver of the car, 17-year-old boy. He's been nothing but problem for me. He can stew in it. I won't come. He never did come near the hospital. Never did. Well, 7 divorces among the 8 parents. No 2 parents belonged to and practiced any kind of formal religious affiliation. There were a couple wives or husbands or something that had some kind of a tenuous relationship, but none of them ever worshiped together in any way at all. Problems in every family. And the kids then did the predictable things of rebel, and they went out either sneaking out or just rebelling their way out of the home and got themselves royally drunk. Now, if we had done a good job with those kids and those families, we could have prevented one bad sequel. I remember the day that the driver of the car was released from the hospital. An orthopedic surgeon came to me and sat down and he said, well, Joe, or whatever the guy's name was, Joe's going home, and then he started to cry. The Jewish orthopedic surgeon, and I've learned down through 40 years of very close association with medical people that, and I guess as a group, Jewish doctors are the most compassionate and personal of all. If you take 1,000 of them, compare them with 1,000 of any other. And the reason is Old Testament anthropology, the kind of thing we've been trying to talk about, the nature of the wholeness of man, their person related, Jewish family has is greater strengths than what Gentile families do on the average, and of course there are exceptions on both sides, you understand. But the father is still, at least symbolically and theoretically, the kind of the rabbi, the priest in his home, and at confirmation it isn't a matter of how well is the preacher done and teaching the kids before they're confirmed, but they're kind of Lutheran at this point. It's the father who has to, is responsible, and at the bar mitzvah, it is the father who is really on trial, and the rabbi is in effect saying, all right, son, let's see how well your father did in teaching you the faith. And we don't do that. The catechism was designed, of course, for fathers, not for pastors. Unless the pastors are fathers. But it's a handbook dedicated to fathers. But instead of that, we've got this whole, well, I don't want to get started on it, but I regard the biggest weakness in Protestantism as being the Sunday school, which invites parents to take, to pass away, to get rid of their responsibilities for communicating the faith. And it also farms out, away from the family then, the exercise of spiritual values. Tends to do this, and we ought to get that returned to the family, and in a hurry. But anyway, this Jewish doctor or big surgeon sits down and cries in my office, and I said, what's the matter? And he said, all we did was put bones together. And I went over and sat down alongside him because this was a very profound pain he was experiencing, and told him what good things he had done saving those lives. And he said, yes, we fought so hard, but we really didn't do anything for those kids. Well, before the last of the 4 of them got out of the hospital, that same guy that caused the orthopedic surgeon to cry, because he had loved this kid by this time, The kid got out, and within 3 weeks, before the last one got out of the hospital, of that group, he was back in. Same kind of a symptom, the same disease. He had gone again off the freeway. A remarkable similarity that, of course, wouldn't, that was accidental or coincidental. But he went off the same freeway within a mile, driving a car again over 90 miles an hour, but this time, and miraculously, he lived through it again. Tragically, he lived through it. But he stuck his brain into the windshield and jarred it so badly that it was more like jelly. And again, we saved his life physically. And about 2 months after that, he was going to be released from the hospital. And his mother brought him over to me and wanted him to say thank you to the nice man who had been so kind to them. And the kid stands here. Yeah. We weren't sending much home. And he'd never be different than that. That brain was so badly battered. We hadn't healed. Now, sure, we'd healed the physical things, you know, but we weren't even geared up at that time to deal with persons. Hospitals are fantastically good at curative medicine. And they recognize diseases right now, except for a few of the very exotic ones that are a little hard to find. But our generation still doesn't know much about illness. And there's a difference, and we need to get at the distinction between illness and disease. Disease is something that a part of you has, like an organ has, or or blood cells have, or something of that nature. That's what disease is. Now, sure, it involves the whole person. But an illness is what the person has. And I would define the illness from which man suffers as his brokenness, which is reflected or made visible in many, many ways. And I think it stems right from the fall, that there was the first of the brokenness, as we broke a relationship with God. And living in that brokenness, there's brokenness in every life, in every moment of every life, but not complete or altogether kind of brokenness, but the degree to which we become broken, that is broken in our relationship to God, to our fellow man, to ourselves, broken in bones, in chemistry, in organ function, in ability to reason, broken in our emotions. I understand I'm using this word now in a very broad kind of a sense, but I don't know a better word to use than brokenness. And it becomes essential that we learn to see diseases in the context of the illness, which is what the person has. And then treat persons. You know, there's nothing new about this. Aristotle, Socrates, rather, was once asked by his sons, how come, uncle, not by his nephews, how come, uncle, that medicine, or the healing arts, over in the neighboring province, seem to be so much better than in our own? How come? And Socrates said, because over there, they treat the person and thus heal his parts. Kind of interesting. We're starting to catch up to Socrates a little bit at this point. See, in between, we took man apart so much, and all the specialists got going, including theologians and preachers and teachers and social workers and doctors and scientists, you know, fractured the man. We need to get back to this essential and almost primitive understanding of what a human being is, and that is the human being that Scripture presents. There was a guy by the name of Cassells, a doctor, writing in the Hastings Report, and if you're interested in the experimental, the ethics of some experimental things and the great biomedical ethical controversies, this institute at Hastings on the Hudson puts out a magnificent little journal. It comes out about 4 times a year. That's extremely helpful. It's just called the Hastings Report. It costs you about $16 a year, I guess, to get it. But Cassell's writing in that a little while ago, with a little bit of whimsy in the way he presents things, says that an illness is what you have on the way to the doctor. A disease is what you have when you come home. Now, by that he meant, you go to the doctor and you say, "Hey, doctor, I am sick." And the doctor pokes around for a while and he takes some blood and he sends it into the lab and he does his fantastic things in connection with diagnosis. And then he says, "Hey, I got news for you. It's your gallbladder that's sick." And the patient kind of in effect says, "Oh," and all the time I thought it was me. Or something like that. So then you get into the hospital and you got a gallbladder in room 302. And you can get terribly jealous of your gallbladder. It gets all the attention. A friend of mine who was a PhD candidate in Harvard way back when I was in training in the 40s, just after getting out of the Navy, hit by an automobile one night and really racked up. I got the story the next day because he had been brought into the hospital where I was training in the middle of the night. And the story was a fantastic one, but a very eloquent one at the point of what we're talking about right now. He had been found unconscious on the street, and the ordinances in Boston wouldn't allow anybody to pick him up or touch him or bring him to the nearest hospital. It had to be a city ambulance that picked him up and took him to the city hospital. Well, it was way far away from where he'd been hit. They're changing some of these laws now, but in most cities, that's pretty close. If you find an unconscious person, you better stay away. We're starting to get around some of that now with some of the new Good Samaritan laws and some other things. The poor guy was picked up and brought into the emergency room of the hospital where I was working. It was Boston City. And he came to, regained consciousness just as they were taking him out of the ambulance. And then they went to work on him and saved his life and saved the use of his legs, which were badly hurt. I came around about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I had a card that had his name on. His name wasn't very common, but it wasn't impossible at all that two people had the same name. And so after taking care of my own responsibilities in the hospital at the time, I went up to this fellow's room and stuck my head in, and here was a fellow that was all bandaged up and one leg going up to the northwest and one to the southeast and, bandaged all over his head and everything. And I came over and looked kind of close down into his eyes that were unbandaged and looked at him and I said, "Oh, it is you." And he said, "Well, you're the first one that's found that out." Then he started to tell me with considerable anger what it was like to be brought into a hospital. He was really fuming. He said, "Nobody has known that I'm here." "What do you mean by that? Looks like you've had a lot of care." He said, "They sure bandaged me up, but that's different." Well, we talked about this a good deal over the weeks that followed. What had happened was he started to regain consciousness when he coming into the hospital, and the very first thing he heard was the ambulance driver, you know, bored with just going around picking up people all night long. But he had a unique fact, a somewhat unique fact, and it was that this was a hit run. So he said, "Yeah, we got a hit run." Now, this is the first thing he hears when he comes in out of some kind of a veil of mist back here and regains consciousness. And he hears the driver saying, almost with some little excitement, "Hey, we got a hit run." And it began to dawn, talking about me. Then the doors were swung open and somebody said, "An emergency." He was the emergency. And he heard himself referred to as a case, an admission, a patient. Never Joe Doakes, you know. A very prominent orthopedic surgeon was called in because it was an unusual fracture of bone in his leg. And he said, "You should have heard that one." But that guy had 15 people walking around to listen to him on rounds. Other doctors and residents and nurses and some others. A very famous guy. Stood with his back to the patient in the doorway of the room, the patient back here. Another anecdotal that may help. Back around 1949 or 50, I was one day running for a week running an institute at Mayo's down in Rochester for physicians and clergymen, trying to get them together a little bit. And on the second morning of the institute, we were supposed to have a very fine and deeply committed Christian surgeon speak to the group about how he related his religious faith to the practice of medicine or practice of surgery. But he fell off his boat over in the Mississippi River at Winona the afternoon before and drowned. A tragic thing, this very fine, brilliant young Christian man. One of his closest friends was the head of the Department of Internal Medicine in the hospital. And he had gone over to comfort the widow, who was also, of course, a very dear friend. And the widow had said, "I'm sure that George would like to have this speech, this manuscript, read to the doctors and pastors tomorrow morning, because he worked so hard on it and regarded it as so very important, the things he wanted to say." So Dr. Reinerson picks up this manuscript and starts to read it and decides that indeed it had to be read. So he came offering to read the manuscript of his friend who had died the afternoon before. And he contacted me late at night, and we arranged to meet at breakfast so I could brief him a little bit on what the Institute was all about. And he was to go on about 9 o'clock. We met at 7 o'clock, and I learned something extremely important from him that morning. The talk that he read was a brilliant thing and a fine testimony of faith. But The thing that I remember most out of the morning was something that Dr. Reinierson told me at breakfast. He said he thought that he told more persons, more people, than did any other doctor in the country, that they either had or had not cancer. And I said, well, I'm surprised at that in a couple of ways. One of them is, why don't you just leave that to the other doctors in this crowd instead of the head of the department, you know, seeing so many people and revealing their answers at all? Because I have to be sure that it's done with concern and sensitivity. And I said, well, it must be a dreadful thing to have to tell so many people that they have cancer. And he said, no, there's something worse than telling the people who come here that they have cancer. And that's to tell them that they don't have cancer. And I, of course, couldn't understand what he was saying. You have to understand what Mayo's is like. Now, it was more like that in 1949 than today, but it was the place of last resort. Remember? They come from all over the world when they had tried everything else. People who had pain and agony would go to their own doctor, and he would run through the test and say, I can't find anything wrong with you. Well, then they'd get a little disgusted and go to a doctor that they thought was had a little better reputation or something, and then go through the same thing. Then they'd end up going to the university clinics or something, something like that, a little bit more prestigious place. And finally, in desperation, would say, well, go to Mayo's because they can find it. And then Mayo's would run them through all the elaborate testing that they could produce and examinations. And with that kind of person now, who has gone from one place to another looking for a solution and an explanation for the deep agony and pain, even physical pain now, because our emotional, spiritual pains tend to get into the physical act and express also. And he said, here we are, these people need desperately an explanation for their pain. And we have nothing to say to them. And then he said, that's where we have to get together, and we have to start talking, and we have to find resources. You see, people don't have any, the kind of, the category that I'm talking about now, don't have any respectable clothing to put around this kind of agony. Cancer is a better explanation. Dreadful as that is, it at least explains, is commensurate with the amount of pain. But if you said, oh, there's nothing wrong with you, good news for you, nothing wrong with you, go on home, you know, or it's all in your head.
You can expect to live that way for another 30 years.
Exactly. Unhealed. Because they have an illness for which there isn't a disease. A respectable, acceptable disease. Other than that, you're nuts, man. Yeah.
Fritz, could we extend this thinking a little bit further now? I'd like to get some direction from you. You've been talking about the total person and the need to heal and work with a total person. And we're at an age now where there is a lot of gene manipulation, and there's a whole new field that's opening up, and the doctors themselves are alarmed about the ethics of it and so forth. It would seem to me that that concept of the total person would have an extreme part to play in any development or non-development or cessation of that whole exploration.
I think I missed a phrase in there. What are you speaking about specifically?
Gene manipulation.
Oh, gene?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Bringing in new life, the DNA manipulation, all this stuff that...
And psychosurgery.
Cybernetics or...
Well, there are all kinds of things that are involved. But
yeah.
Yes. I was at a meeting in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, about 4 years ago, where they brought together 15 futurists, or scientists, among whom were many of whom were futurists, try to, these are the guys who are experts in predicting what's going to be the situation down the road 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now. And so there were 15 of those and 15 theologian types. And we sat together for a week. And many of the scientists were making a plea that somehow or another we had to get at theological, metaphysical, philosophical, social input into the context in which they were doing their research. The most eloquent on this was Jose Delgado, who manipulates people or manipulates animals, chimps, either by chemistry or by electronics. Makes them do anything that he pleases by pushing buttons. He stopped. You may have seen him on Time magazine back about 4 years ago. Just after this conference, Delgado had wired up a bull, a bullring bull, and then he carried a little electronic gadget like a garage door opener in his pocket, and he had them go ahead and deal with the bull just like they do in a bullfight, and they had gotten the bull to the place where he was absolutely enraged, and the picadors had been at their gruesome task. And then Delgado dismissed everybody in the ring and steps out from behind the barrier with a little thing, and I've held it in my hand, it's smaller than a pack of cigarettes. And he walked out towards this enraged bull with no cape and no sword or any of that sort of thing. He walks up toward the bull, and the bull's scratching away and his head down and coming. And when the bull started to charge, he pushed the button on this thing, and the bull just stopped cold and just stood there. Now, Delgado can do this with very simple little insertions of some electrodes down in the brain in that case. He can also do it by a little tiny little pump that he puts in that's electronically operated, that squeezes a little bulb that's got some chemicals in it and shoots it into parts of the brain. But he can call for, in a chimpanzee, you know, he can call for rage, hostile rage, which isn't like chimps. And then say, and I've seen these movies where a clock hand is going around, at exactly 4 minutes after the hour, I will push this button and you'll see the maternal instinct come out in this enraged chimp. And he pushes the button just when it comes to exactly where it's supposed to be on the clock. He pushes the button, you see the movie of the hand pushing the button, and in the background you see the chimp that's been terrorizing the other chimps in the cage. All of a sudden it stops and goes over and picks up a little baby chimp and holds it to her breast and pats it. Delgado said at that one, hey, buddy, to all of us, let's get with it. You know what happened when they split the atom and it became a bomb? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to play any part with that. Somehow or another, somebody's going to have to find a way to assure me that there will be good control of what we are discovering. Otherwise, I must stop my research at this point. He was doing this with some humans in mental hospitals with very salutary effects, uncontrollable situations, which are rare. But now, how in the world do you get the input of let's say you just take simple one, the theology, into such things as the growing edge of the most sophisticated way out research. I think I mentioned yesterday the splitting of the brain. doctors are getting very much concerned about this, but where is the theological input into the question of who is it when you transplant a hemisphere of the brain? Does the soul get transplanted now? Is that something, or what are we talking about? If you're going to, and one of the things that came out at the King of Prussia conference was now that we can, or are just about ready to tailor man to our own style, our own fashion, who is going to determine the kind of man you want? That was the primary question they were asking. Because you can modify personality. And you can do it very easily by drugs, you know. But you can now do it by tapping off some fluid in the placenta, finding out what the chromosomal structure is of the yet unborn baby. And then you can take several courses. You can, for instance, find that there is some deficiency in that baby, like in the case of Down syndrome, that results in mongolism, may decide to abort at that point. And that gets to be an issue that is not a medical issue. There's no problem, there's nothing, no medical problem with abortion. That's just a very simple kind of a procedure that's long ago mastered. But the problems there are social and religious and spiritual and legal, and you know, that's where the problems come in abortion. But now, the next step is that you take out the defective gene and replace it with a healthy gene by implanting. Now, that's right around the corner. Some successful experiments with this already announced. And the new gene takes over as dominant. And the structure of the person gets changed. I wish I had with me here, and I regret that some or another stuff that should have come here with me got into our storage business. I mean, I won't see it for a year, but there's an article by Bentley Glass, one of the world's most renowned geneticists, and he starts talking about what happens now when you start forming the human being by modifying his genes and the chromosomal structures. And he predicts that by the year 2000, there will be 12 of man's most common diseases that have a genetic base of some kind or another, that we're going to be able, and not only able, but we probably will be modifying. But because of the nature of reproduction and gene communication, he predicts that about 75% of all human beings will be afflicted with several of these diseases by that time, or conditions. Diabetes is a good example. That's a very common one, huh? And in 1918, there were very few diabetics in the United States. The reason was, by percentage and population, the reason was that most of them didn't live to reproduce. Most people who had diabetes did not live long enough to reproduce. Now, of course, they live long enough to reproduce. So we have an explosion in diabetes in the United States. An enormous amount of diabetes today. Now, nobody's going to say you shouldn't allow diabetics to live, for goodness sakes. But the annual cost of treating diabetes in the United States is something like $3 billion. You don't put a dollar value on life now. But now if you go on, and says Bentley Glass, to find that in Down syndrome, that control that one now so that people with Down's genes grow up and reproduce, because this is now already probably possible. It looks like the first stages of this have already proved it. Then you're going to have an explosion of Down's in the country, a genetic disorder. And then he went on and listed 10 more and then said, then he gave some kind of a figure, like that if the costs remain somewhat the same per unit or per person and this sort of thing, that we use up more than 50% of the nation's gross national product by the year 2100. A very live discussion going on. Who shall be allowed to reproduce? Maybe that the marriage goes by the board, that's conceivable, but you can bet your bottom dollar that the day will come when you'll have to have a license to have a baby. You may not have to have a license to get married, but you're probably going to have a license to have a baby. Now, not so much because of overpopulation of the planet. That's a problem in some places. It doesn't happen to be an American problem. We don't really have overpopulation. But if we are tampering with the nature of genetic disorder so that people can live and reproduce, then it may be necessary to say, hey, your card's got a restriction on it. You've got some downs in your background and in your genes, and we can't allow you to have a baby. Now, you can see all kinds of controls coming. Who's going to be wise enough to call the shots on what these controls are? If you then go the step further and get at the cloning so that you bank the ideal genes and do the real test tube baby bit, so that you have superior, quotes, source, genetic source for those human beings that are produced. And who's going to decide what kind of a human being it ought to be? Glass suggests that, and keep in mind this a few years back now that he wrote this, but he said that obviously all the women would turn out to be Gina Lolo Brigida and all the men Einstein. And what a boring world it was going to be. Well, everybody gets a point across by saying it. The ethics of DNA, RNA experiment and application of that knowledge are of fantastic importance. I personally just don't even get excited anymore about the abortion thing at all, except in the individual case, because it seems to me almost a trivial consideration in the face of some of these other things. And we haven't even begun to think our way into the implications. Now, what is man? Is man what man makes him to be? In a day of fantastically advanced technology? Well,
it's building towers of Babel, isn't it?
I don't know.
If it causes them to lose sight of God.
Well, yes, if that does it, surely. But maybe this is part of subduing the earth. Maybe we're asked now to be responsible, you know, free, but responsible. Just think now, if we could eliminate the symptoms of Down syndrome, so that instead of having kids running around mentally retarded and maybe otherwise physically handicapped and looking a little different, that they're set free from that.
But they still carry the genes.
But they still carry the genes, you see. Now at that point, we have an ethical problem. Do you allow reproduction or do you not?
And you also have the problem that if the technology breaks down, which can reduce the symptoms, then you have this gene bank explode in the society and cause massive problems.
Now, on the other hand, is anybody ready to go back to just letting them die? I have had to walk that lonely road way too many times when I sit around with parents and doctors and nurses and others trying to make a decision to whether a little baby is going to survive or not when it comes into this world with multiple handicaps. Let's just say Down's, which is probably going to result in some, is somewhat incapacitating or seriously incapacitating retardation. And then, for instance, if that same baby has some other physical or genetic kinds of anomalies, like a flipper arm or and no connection between the stomach and the intestines, and you got to go cutting into a little baby immediately after birth to make a, to do that surgery, knowing that that might make it possible for the baby now to ingest food and to survive. But then what are the other problems and who's taking care of them? And to hear the anguish of parents at this point saying, okay, doctor, you say you can do the surgery, and because you can do it, you think you ought to do it, but will you take care of this baby for the rest of your life when we get him home? Common one from parents. And somebody has to decide. And if you decide to let the baby go, then some nurse or nurses have to stand around for someplace between a week and 3 weeks and watch the baby dehydrate and die. And there just ain't no good answer. To do nothing is a horrible thing. To do everything we can is probably equally horrible. It's rough.
Advanced technology has brought a lot of good, but it also has opened up Pandora's box. It's
created some dilemma, but I would go with the modern technology. We're better off today.
At least we can make the choice.
At least we can make the choice. But anybody who's had to live in or be close to primitive societies, where you see people who haven't had as much as an aspirin for pain ever, you know that that's no bargain either. Well, that was a coffee bell, I suppose, long ago.
Thank you.